This podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing connection to land, waters, and culture. Colonization and genocide are ongoing processes that are still continuing to this day. Sovereignty was never ceded, and this always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Auspol Snack Pod, the show where we serve you up bite-sized chunks of Australian news and politics with a side of crispy memes. We are just like a regular news show, except we say fuck sometimes. We're also the official podcast of the Auspol Shitposting Facebook group. I myself am a mod in said group. My name is Zach LeSnack, and with me is my trusted advisor and close companion.
Hey, I'm Noon. I'm the admin creator of Auspol Shitposting, and I'm very happy to be back doing another show with you, Zach.
Always a pleasure, Noon. Nice to see your blurry little face over the internet.
My ridiculous hat.
It looks extremely cozy. I'm very jealous, actually.
It is. And actually, I wanted to start the show off on a positive note. We do have some more intro stuff to say, but I'm wearing this hat because it's absolutely freezing in Melbourne at the moment. It was actually this month we've had the coldest April day in like 5 or 6 or 7 decades in many different parts of the country. But it was also the 5th warmest April on record in Australia, despite also hitting our record of colds. So we're all going to die from global warming. And just a little positive thing to start off with.
I feel like it can be quite refreshing to get sort of dunked in like a hot spa and then jump in a cold pool. Is that not just sort of what we're doing to the planet?
That's true. Yeah. We're all going to be in a Swedish sauna, both the boiling and the freezing, almost simultaneously. Sauna.
Sauna. Yeah. Then we're all going to get the back of our legs whipped with those special leaves that make your legs sting. I read it in a book once. All right, cool. Anyway, moving on. shouts to our new patrons. We got a few over the last 2 weeks. Thank you to Raph, Tal, and also John. We appreciate it so much for signing up.
Tal.
My bad. Thank you, Tal. We appreciate it hugely. And if you are someone who likes what we do and want to support us, you can hop over to Patreon and support us for as little as $1 a month to get you a monthly bonus episode and a whole bunch of other stuff, including access to our Discord server. Probably time to get into our entree this week.
Yeah.
Noon? Yeah. All right. What have you brought for us?
So I've just got a couple of like proper politics stories. Parliament hasn't been around. It's been a little while since we've had an election. So this is just some like real classic politics content for you. There's two different things. One is that the Queensland state election is coming up. It's on the 31st of October. And as many listeners will know, Queensland is hilariously a unicameral parliament, which means they only have one house. They don't have a Senate. As I understand it, the Senate in Queensland was abolished for being a tool of the monarchy and aristocracy, which it is in Britain, but it's not in Australia. So I think that's very funny. Every time Queensland politics happens, I'm like, just that by itself is always
losers
a funny fact.
With only one cameral... A single cameral?
Camera? Yeah. but the sort of news that's come out this week is that the Treasurer, Jackie Trad, is in a very close seat between Labour and the Greens. The Labour is in power, obviously, so she's the Labour Treasurer. And last election, they were within 500 votes of Amy McMahon, who was the Greens candidate. She was within 500 votes of winning the seat. And
that was a big swing as well from memory. It was like a 10% swing towards... McMahon, the Greens candidate.
And so she's standing again against Jackie Trad. But this year, the LNP, the Liberal National Party, which is both of those parties smooshed together, because again, Queensland's hilarious, they're putting Labour at the bottom of the ticket. So that's going to be like under Family First and everyone else. But most importantly, it's under the Greens. So last year, I'm pretty sure the Libs preferenced Labour ahead of the Greens, and this year they won't. So it looks very possible that the Treasurer will get booted.
Seeing a few Labour hacks crying foul on Twitter and socials and the like, being like, the Greens have done a preference deal with the LNP. But it's like, bro, last time you were above the Greens on the ticket, so does that make you LNP collaborators?
Deal? Yeah. Look, if there's one thing I've learnt from Left Renewal, 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 it's that Labour hacks don't even care about trying to be honest or fair. So, you know.
Doesn't seem to get in the way of you relentlessly enjoying their content and
no, absolutely not. Though I also rage enjoy it quite a lot. You know, it's a mix of actually being like, well, that's a point, and God, these people are just the literal worst scum of the Australian political meme scene.
Shouts to Joe Mama. Mm-hmm. Noon is a big fan.
I'm a big something. I don't know if it's a fan.
You can say that again.
Okay, so that's one politics roundup thing. And the other one is that Mike Kelly is resigning. And he's the Labour Minister member for Eden Manara, which is an interesting seat, which I'll talk about in a sec. But he is leaving Parliament because he's been through 10 surgical procedures over the last 6 months. And it looks like he might need more. And his partner is also quite sick. So, yeah, he's leaving Parliament to spend more time with his family and looking after his
body.
That's
really rough.
Yeah. And these surgeries have been to treat kidney conditions that he acquired by being dehydrated for a long time while on tour in the army. And he was actually...
Oh, wow.
Which is like, you know, mixed react. he's, in fact, a colonel, and he was one of Australia's top-ranked military officials during the Iraq War, which... you know, that, like, stunned, embarrassed emoji that's, like, the big wide eyes and the flat mouth? Yeah, that's my response to him being one of our top-ranked officials in the Iraq War.
I love the military-to-politics pipeline. One of my favorites.
More traditionally a liberal thing, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, I like Andrew Wilkie, but he was very, like, a bit more of a whistleblowy type military person. So, look... And when I say like, I mean, you know, he's a politician. So
yeah, yeah.
That term is obviously relative.
Mike Kelly finished his career as the head of the Department of, like, Military Legal Affairs. And when I was reading the article, I thought he'd actually been promoted to a colonel for his legal service in the military. But no, I'm pretty sure it was for, like, actual, like, combat oversight or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned Eden Monaro, which is an interesting seat. It's the New South Wales seat that surrounds the ACT. So the ACT is like a little dot taken out of the middle of Eden Monaro. So it's basically
it's
like...
It's a donut.
Yeah, exactly. Has Bega in it, amongst other places. And it
cheesy
is...
Cheesy donut.
It's a bellwether, which means it's a seat that people look to during elections, and whoever wins it, they're like, well, they're going to win the election. And it's not the only one, but he's the first... Mike Kelly is the first person to serve in opposition as the member for Eden Monaro since 72. So it's been like a good 50 years of it being an accurate bellwether of whoever was in Eden Monaro was also in government. So Mike Kelly actually got in Parliament in 2007 with Kevin Rudd, and he was elected to Eden Monaro as the bellwether, and it was correct. And then he lost the seat in 2013 when Tony got elected, again, it being an accurate bellwether. But then he won it again in 2016, which was the election that Shorten lost. And I remember when we had the Auspol drinks night, I was like, oh, Eden Monaro is sick. That's like, Labor's going to win now. And then they didn't. So, yeah. So there's going to be a by-election because Mike Kelly's resigning, and it looks likely that Labor's going to keep it because no government has won a seat from an opposition at a by-election in over a century. But, you know, they hadn't won Eden Monaro for more than 50 years, so, you know, we'll see. So watch this space. And that's
it. By-elections are always fun. Always bring a whole lot of silly shenanigans with them and lots of breathless political reporting. So I'm sure that will give us plenty of fodder. Is that your own fart you're smelling?
No, it's Bagel. Yeah, he's eating a gross snack that I gave him to distract him. Bagel's my dog, listeners, for those who don't know. Anyway, that's it for the entree. Shall we move on to our second most alcoholic sting?
I think you said you had written in the notes this is going to be a really tiny round of Corona, so I thought I might
maybe
do a little
like
gag.
Shots.
I'll play. No, I'm not going to do another sting. I'm just going to play the current one really fast.
Cool.
High pitched. I think it'll be funny.
Yeah.
Hey, man, it's Morbius. Oh, I don't know if I can drink anymore. I'm feeling kind of sick. Come on, we're having another round of Coronas.
I don't think I can drink anymore. Cool. I love it. All right. So this is our only like real big Corona story for the week, and it's that the COVID Safe app was launched, which is the government's app to track the population and try and figure out when people have had contact with other cases of coronavirus and so on. There were 2 million downloads in the first 24 hours, and as of last night, there were 3 million. And the government has been definitely not saying that they want 40% of the population or more to download it. That's a figure from other countries, that 40%. And the chief medical officer has been saying, well, you know, I don't want to say we're aiming for 40%. Just whatever we get is great, and the more the merrier sort of thing. But it looks like 40% is really what they're aiming for. News poll found that 54% of people were happy to download it. And Zach and I kind of talked about this briefly, and we don't really have any super strong hot takes about it. We'll probably do some more reading, but like neither of us are tech guys.
So much of the conversation seems to be revolving around the safety of the data and that kind of thing, which is not a conversation that I feel in any way qualified to contribute to. I'm definitely opposed to anything that tells the government more about me on principle, and not just about me, but like specifically the people who will have their data used to target them.
So absolutely.
Which is, you know, already marginalized and over-policed communities. So on that basis, we're thoroughly opposed to it. But I'm not sure that we have like... It was like, oh, we should talk about the app this week. And then we were like,
what are we going to say about it?
We don't really have like that much to say about it. So we might look into it more and maybe we'll talk about it another week.
And I'd like to invite listeners who do know about this or who do have strong opinions about it to send us potlucks, because that's, you know, the perfect thing for potluck is topics that Zach and I feel ill-informed about. And so we would love your opinions. I've definitely read very convincing points on both sides of downloading versus not downloading. The only other thing that I wanted to mention about that story is that there's been a hoax SMS been going out that's being investigated by the federal police. And the message says the app has detected you've gone more than 20 meters from your home. You need to call the government on this number immediately. And I read a story about someone who got this message who had freaked out because they were still at home and then were like desperately trying to uninstall the app and accidentally told them that they had coronavirus as a big schlamozzle.
Which
they did not. Yeah. Anyway.
Jesus. Because the app doesn't actually record your location data is like an important point to note. It's a Bluetooth thing and it's about your proximity to other people who have the app, who also have it enabled.
Yep.
So I don't know. There's a longer and more detailed discussion to be had about it, but
not this week. Yep. Cool. Do you want to take us maybe through our next segment, Zach?
Okay, I'll do what I can.
Shitpost of the week.
Because honestly, I came late to this one. So this week I'm awarding shitpost of the week to someone that you all know, someone that that a few of you might love, and some of you that a number of you have a bone to pick with, and that is, of course, our... not erstwhile admin Eno Funkenstein, aka Noon. Oh my god.
Oh wow,
twist.
I'm so unexpected. I didn't realize there's I'd like to thank the Academy.
A lot of shit posters out there being like, this is so solipsistic. How
nepotism.
Dare you award a shit posting award to yourself? Well, it's not to me, it's to Noon. And I actually missed there was a lot of shenanigans on the page. Which I was later informed by my partner. She was like, hey, you seen this stupid beg button shit that's going on Ospol shitposting? I was like, no, what the fuck are you talking about? What's a beg button? That's a term I've literally never heard before.
You and everybody else, my friend.
So basically, Noon made a post about how he saw some people wiping shit down in public, presumably related to Corona.
Really
disinfecting
badly. They were
surfaces.
Doing a terrible job of it, and it was very funny to watch them operate. I was out walking by dog, and I bumped into them at like three different parts of the road as they traveled one direction, I traveled the other and like did little loops and stuff. And every single time, at least one of them was wiping something hilarious. the photo that I first posted is in front of this big green fence, and someone just like sprayed the middle of it and like wiped, you know, like maybe a square foot of it, and then they kept going.
Disinfectant. It's important.
Yep.
But what Noon mentioned, that one of the things that these people were wiping down was something that he termed beg buttons. There were then about like 80 comments,
78 comments
on this post, on this post that had like maybe 20, a dozen
18
likes.
Reacts. Yeah, I checked last night. I got extremely ratioed. It was like a 4-1.
That's a big ratio of everyone just being like, what the fuck is a beg button? Why are you talking about beg buttons, Noon? Noon being like, this is the actual term for the button that you press at the traffic lights at the pedestrian crossing when you want to go across.
Yes.
They're called beg buttons. Everyone's like, is this a Victorian localized slang? Is this an Albany expression? Other people being like, I've lived in Victoria all my life. I've never heard this stupid term before.
Yeah, it's not polls a Victorian expression. Opened. I learned it from NumTots, new urbanist memes for transit-oriented teens, like maybe 2 years ago. And I was like, huh, I'd never heard that term before, but it makes perfect sense, especially because in many intersections, the buttons don't actually prompt the lights to change. And that was something that I actually loved when I moved to Melbourne, was when you press the button, a little light flicks on, whereas where I grew up in Sydney, there's almost no illuminated
indication
buttons.
That you've yeah. even been acknowledged by
right,
the
right,
button,
right.
And begging or not.
The reason that these buttons are there is to stop people jaywalking. And like, I'm not, there are definitely some intersections where the buttons are connected to the lights and pressing it makes the lights change. But a lot of them, especially in like busy areas, CBD and stuff, it's just on a timer and the button is just there so that you feel like your request to cross has been
it's
acknowledged.
It's a placebo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Hence the name beg button, because you're like, please, oh, please let me cross, please.
And the timer is like, I acknowledge and change for
asked.
No human or desire.
Yeah.
I will do what I do, regardless of whether you have begged or not.
Mm-hmm.
But look, basically, a bit of a shitpost storm ensued. Noon did his own shitposts. Other people put out their own shitposts. A number
a good
of really
one.
Horrific, like,
from Alexander
anthropomorphizations
yeah.
of buttons, which are just horrifying.
Push
to me.
Me, please. I'm beg.
Oh, stop. No, gross. Don't.
It was a post from Dex Stocker, who posted a photo of an actual beg button that he has in his living room for some reason and said, not to flex too hard, y'all, but dot, dot, dot. And also Hugh Alistair, posted this classic Rugrats meme. Dee Dee, is that a name? Comes in and says to Stu, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. Why on earth are you researching pedestrian button design? And Stu says, because I've lost control of my life.
Classic format, as I always say. More Rugrats memes, please. More Rugrats templates. So congratulations, Noon, on your terrible post. Obviously, it's called the pedestrian light crossing button or just the button. Doesn't matter whether or not the term you suggest is technically correct.
Mm-hmm.
We can all agree that common usage takes precedence, and you've done a bad job.
Well,
so moving
I would
on,
like
there's nothing more to say about that.
To just verbally respond with an image of Hannibal Buress saying, why are you booing me? I'm right. And with that, I'm happy to move on.
Yeah, go over to the Ozpol Shitposting Facebook group if you're not part of it already, if you want to see some really dumb posts about pedestrian buttons and also a bunch of other shit.
When Zach says that, he means beg buttons, obviously.
All right, moving on. Now it's time for...
It was the best of...
Takes.
It was the blurst of...
Takes.
You stupid monkey!
So we've got kind of a... Well, it's... I don't know if it's a blurst take or a blessed take.
Mm.
It's definitely a take. It's a
it
take
is.
Somewhere in the middle.
Or possibly both. We have had a few double blessed and blurst. Anyway, this one is going out to Victorian Deputy Chief Health Officer Annelies von Diemen. Who tweeted the other day, sudden arrival of an invader from another land, decimating populations, creating terror, forces the population to make enormous sacrifices and completely change how they live in order to survive. COVID-19 or Cook 1770?
Ooh. Damn, third eye open.
Yep. I like the COVID-19 or Cook 1770. yeah.
What happened to the first 1,769 cooks?
Mm-hmm.
You ever think about that?
Annelies.
I mean, look. On the one hand, it's not a great comparison because, like, the arrival of Europeans on this continent was far more devastating for the local populations than
coronavirus
the COVID
has been, yeah.
Yeah.
But
on the other hand,
like an intentionality thing, you know, like coronavirus is a virus. It's just doing its thing. Whereas like the British colonial empire was like a conscious decision by dickheads to invade and murder people. You know, like I feel like
yeah, it's not an, it wasn't like a natural disaster.
Mm.
There are people that you can go and really blame for Captain Cook. But like the reaction to this tweet from the right, basically, and mostly, let's be honest, it's mostly right wing people on Twitter. Yeah, it's just this like outrage and affront and pearl clutching. Because basically any critical reassessment of Australia's colonial legacy is read as a partisan issue by these people.
Yeah.
Which, like, I think you'll find plenty of unquestioningly patriotic and pro-colonial people in the Labor Party, for one thing.
Mm.
And also, this is extremely mild. Like, all that Van Diemen was drawing attention to is, hey, you ever notice how Europeans arriving here was really, really bad for Indigenous people?
Yeah.
And, like, that is a pretty much unequivocal statement of fact. But not if you talk to the...
Like
to
Andrew
the
Bolton people who are like, oh, Mark Latham, these savages and horrible shit like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, their population has actually grown since we arrived or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, absolutely full of shit.
Well, I have a quote here from Victorian opposition health spokeswoman, whose name is Georgie Crozier, and she said that the comments were highly inappropriate at a time when Victoria remains in a state of emergency and that the doctor should resign. And Michael O'Brien, who's the leader of the Victorian Lib, said, Daniel Andrews, Deputy Chief Health Officer, should be working on giving Victorians a pathway out of Labor's lockdown, not giving us woke political commentary on Twitter. And obviously, fuck both of those people, but I just wanted to say that I love every single time a Victorian Liberal minister appears in the media, because I have no idea who any of them are, and every time I encounter a new one and I'm like, who the fuck is this person? I think it's hilarious, because somehow losing Matthew Guy, noted, like, mafia associate,
mobster eater,
somehow made the state Liberals less appealing and...
memorable.
Yeah, yeah. So, anyway,
so, whatever, you know, it's not, like, an amazing take, but, like, no. Maybe, I guess it sort of dovetails relatively nicely into our First Nations story for this week.
Mm.
You want to run us through what you've got on the plate this week for this one, Noon?
Yeah, so, it's kind of weird talking about this as a First Nations story, but also, like, the colonial invasion and genocide of the people of this continent is a story of Indigenous people as well as one of, like, British invasion. And so the reason that this tweet happened was that it was the 250th anniversary of James Cook landing on this continent this week. And there was some stories coming out from First Nations people about their experience of Cook landing, and I just wanted to pass some of that on to our listeners. And obviously last week we played that clip from a Ewan man talking about them seeing the ship sail by, and I'm talking about how it looked like a pelican. This is a story from the Dharawal, who were actually the first people to talk to Cook when they came on shore. A guy called Sidney Parkinson, who was an artist who was employed in the ship that Cook landed on, he wrote in his journal that when they came off board, the local men made threatening gestures with spears and yelled, "Wara wara why?" And he was just like, oh, it must mean go away. And so he wrote that in his journal, and everyone was like, yeah, it must mean go away. But Ray Ingrie, who's a Dharawal man, said that wara is a root word for either white or dead in our language. Over time, because of outsiders trying to tell our story for us, it's just been translated into different parts as go away. If you're outside our community and trying to look in, you'll think it means go away. But for us, it means you're all dead. And he also clarified that, like, that might be interpreted as a threat. But in the context, it was actually them being like, oh, these are, like, literally dead people who have arrived. And he goes on, he says, when our old people saw the Endeavour coming through, they actually thought it was a low-lying cloud because all they could see was whiteness. In Dharawal culture, that low-lying cloud means that the spirits of the dead have returned to their country, and so they almost saw ghosts. So when the two men opposed the landing, they were protecting the country in a spiritual way from ghosts. There's no taking away from the significance of James Cook, clearly is an amazing explorer. However, history shows that when lands are invaded, a lot of the true history is either wiped out or misrepresented, Mr. Ingrie said. For a long time, our community has been saying that we need to tell our story our way. Yeah, and I just wanted to tell one other story, which is from a woman named Teresa Adler, who's a descendant of a Dharawal man named Kuman, who was one of those two men who were yelling at Cook and his crew. And she says that the story passed down in her community, her family, is different than the one in the history books. And she said, I was in high school in year 10 studying Cook, and we were reading a book that said the bullets were fired over the heads. I remember getting up in class and saying, this is wrong, this is not the true history, because my grandfather was shot. I said, everyone needs to rip that page out of your book. And Miss Adler is now fighting for physical evidence of this encounter to be returned to this land. And there's this bark shield with a bullet hole in it, which is called the Guirgal Shield. And that's in the British Museum. And the British Museum said that it's suggested but not confirmed that the shield belonged to the warrior Cooman, who is Miss Adler's ancestor, when he was shot at by Cook's landing party. And she said, we're still waiting to get that shield back. I want to work on some repatriation because it's that very spiritual connection we have with those objects. I have deep sadness leading up to this anniversary, and I've been very much reflecting on my ancestors. Our culture is not dead. It is living and thriving decades on.
That's so fucked that the British Museum has that shield. And, like, I don't know. At the end of the day, it's like it's England that is the root of all this and is yep. still controlling the narrative. Really disappointing. And it's very important, as you say, to listen to these alternate descriptions of this of that history and be critical of what we've been told. There's also another approach that I've seen being taken around this time, which is Indigenous people celebrating themselves and what they've achieved, as well as taking this as a time for kind of remembrance. So I just wanted to direct people to the Wild Black Women podcast, which is a podcast we've shouted out a few times on the show, hosted by Dr. Chelsea Bond and Angelina Hurley. They're really hilarious, and they put out a video this week just basically talking about their take on the anniversary of Cook's Landing and what they are proud of, you know, in terms of what Indigenous people have achieved, not just talking about colonial, you know, endeavor, but acknowledging the achievements of Aboriginal people as well. So that's worth checking out. They've posted that video on their Facebook page and their other socials as well. Definitely tune into their podcast as well. All right, what have we got next, Noon?
You fucked up.
We've got a pretty excellent fuck-up from Mark DiStefano, erstwhile journalist at BuzzFeed, who moved to the Financial Times in January of this year, which I know because until 10 hours ago, his pinned tweet on his Twitter page was from January the 9th, being like, oh, I've just started at the Financial Times. Everyone send me any like classified leaks that you've got. He was suspended from his role in the Financial Times because he was caught listening into a Zoom call in which a British news site called The Independent was telling staff about layoffs and cutbacks and that sort of thing because of coronavirus. So he joined the call. Someone saw his name on the little, like, Zoom thing. And then 16 seconds later, he quit. And then 5 minutes later, a mysterious account with no name joined, but the account was linked to his phone number. And also, like, later that day, the Financial Times published a report by Mark DiStefano about The Independent, including confidential details that were only on this call. And the article stated that, quote, people on the call were the source of the story. And almost exactly the same thing happened with him, like, going into the Evening Standard Zoom call, who assisted a newspaper to The Independent, who were also laying off people. I read the Independent article about this, and they said Independent separately contacted the Financial Times for comment for this article, but they declined. Mark DiStefano has also declined to comment. Anyway, he was suspended because it's fucking illegal and against the, like, code of conduct of the Financial Times to, secretly get involved in a private Zoom or phone call and then report it. The only exception for that is public interest stories, which it seems like yet another company firing people because of a financial crisis is not really like that. Yeah. So anyway,
it's
he's now offered his resignation. It's a weird move.
Yeah, by DiStefano. I don't know. I can't really get my head around it. It seems like a very strangely risky thing for a reporter to do for a story that just isn't that much chop.
Like, also, like, if it was like, I don't know, Coles or BHP or something, like, he could have got away with it so much more easily, but these professional investigative reporters that he was spying on, like, there was zero chance they weren't going to find out about it.
Pick your target, bro. Yeah. Oh my god. Well, R.I.P. Mark. I guess he's taking some time to lick his wounds. Yet another BuzzFeed alumni who has gone on to do disappointing and confusing stuff post-BuzzFeed. So, I don't know. I still respect a number of the reporters that work at BuzzFeed who turn out really good work. But there's something about leaving there and moving on and, yeah, and moving on to the big leagues that seems to, like, I don't know, make reporters go a little bit strange somehow.
Anyway, that's all for the fuck up. Mark is now unemployed and logging off Twitter, apparently. So,
I mean, that's probably a good move for most of us.
Yeah, it's true. Really. It's true. Shall we move on to our main course this week, Zach? What are we having?
Oh, we're having a delicious Forest of Twiglets, a snack which I love, and I'm pretty sure I gave you one time when we were recording, and you were like, oh, "What? This is fucking disgusting. Why would anybody like this? It just tastes like it tastes like a literal twig dipped in Vegemite." To which my answer was, of course, yes, that's delicious.
I don't remember that, but it does sound nicer than my response to it, but I believe you that I didn't enjoy it.
It could have been someone else. Most people hate Twiglets. Not me. I fucking love them. But there's one Twiglet that I've got no fucking time for. And that's Andrew Twiggy Forrest. So Andrew Twiggy Forrest was in the news this week because his foundation, the Mindaroo Foundation, secured, that's in quotes there from me, quotes in my notes, 10 million corona testing kits from China. And then there was a press conference to announce that he had gotten these testing kits that he was conducting with Greg Hunt. And he kind of, the term used in the media has been blindsided or ambushed. But basically, he brought along China's consul general to Victoria and Tasmania, a guy called Zhao Long, and was just like, hey, come up to the podium and defend the Chinese government's actions in regards to the coronavirus, which apparently pissed Greg Hunt off so much that he cancelled another press conference that they were due to have a few days later to announce. It was like $60 million worth of funding for cancer treatment for children, which is, you know, one of those gimme things that, like, if Greg Hunt is cancelling such a, like, good publicity for himself, like, he's clearly upset.
Be really mad. Yeah.
Twiggy Forrest maintains that this wasn't a surprise and that it's being blown out of proportion and stuff. But he clearly didn't take the lesson from doing... He did the same thing about 3 weeks earlier when the Mindaroo Foundation, had secured a whole bunch of personal protective equipment for Western Australia. And so he did a press conference with the Western Australian Health Minister and again invited along a Chinese diplomat to talk, which, as a surprise move. So, I mean, the mainstream media is definitely going hard after Forrest for this and throwing around words like treason, which I think is a little over the top. But basically...
It does seem like maybe he's being paid by China to...
I'm not sure that he's being, well, not exactly, I don't know if he's being paid directly, but he makes all of his money exporting shit to China.
Sure.
So, like, he's, you know, it's his business interests. But okay, so I've been talking about Andrew Twiggy Forrest, and we're talking about Mindaroo, and I haven't mentioned Fortescue Metals, but these are words that I hear getting thrown around in the news all the fucking time. Andrew Forrest this, Mindaroo Foundation that,
Twiggy has
Fortescue
blah, blah, blah.
Metals Group this, yeah, and I'm like, are these words supposed to fucking mean something to me? Because they literally do not. So I thought, I'll do a little bit of reading. I'll do a little bit of research. And I'll find out what the fuck is up with this guy. So, settle in, Noon. Let me tell you a little story.
I'm settled.
All right, so Andrew Forrest, who is also known by his high school nickname Twiggy, is one of the richest assholes in Australia. At one point, he was the richest asshole in Australia. He's currently worth about $8 billion. So he's a mining magnate, basically, and these days he's also really heavily invested in meat and dairy exports to China, where the market for that is growing exponentially, expanding middle class and all that. So he's considered to be Australia's biggest philanthropist, according to Forbes, the rich people magazine for rich people. In 2019, he gave the largest ever donation in Australian history of $655 million.
Wow, that's so generous.
Yeah, so generous. It also happened to go to his own foundation, the Mindaroo Foundation. So, the Mindaroo Foundation, what are they doing? They're securing coronavirus testing kits from China. They're securing personal protective equipment from China. What do they do? What are they up to? Well, I went to their website. I'm just going to read you a little bit of text, which I think should clear it up for you, Noon. I can see that you're kind of, you're a bit confused. What are these guys up to? Well, this should make it really clear.
Okay.
Mindaroo Foundation is a modern philanthropic organization. We take on tough, persistent issues with the potential to drive massive change. We incubate ideas and accelerate impact. We push the limits of what is believed possible. So that should clear it up for you.
I now understand what their purpose and day-to-day operations are.
Yes, exactly. I think that's what they were going for. Some of the initiatives, so they're, you know, a philanthropic organization. They've got about $2 billion committed to various initiatives around the world. So we're talking pretty big spenders here. This is an organization set up by Twiggy, by Andrew Forrest. I'm going to stop calling him Twiggy because I don't think he deserves a term of endearment.
Yep.
It's
fair.
Because fuck all billionaires. But some of the things that they're interested in is closing the gap, as in between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people, ending slavery, and ocean health, which I've got written here in my notes. Real Bond villain type shit. Not as in they're like...
Like, those are all good goals.
Those are all good goals, but it just really stinks of, like, you know, every Bond villain has a charitable organization. Uh-huh. And they're always like, oh yeah, I'm super concerned with Amazon health or whatever. And then it turns out they're doing some shady shit behind the scenes. So it's just really what it stinks of to me.
Well, I don't want to jump the gun, if that's the right expression, but about, like, all of those things are things that he makes worse.
Interesting.
Exploits First Nations labor and has slaves and is a mining magnate and ruins ocean health. So, yeah.
What's the opposite of burying the lead?
Ruining
blowing
the joke?
Blowing up my lead?
Anyway, please keep telling us about
this. You're not ruining it. It's no secret that this billionaire is a piece of shit.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that we can pretty much take that as read.
I don't know. I just think it's funny that he chose charitable organizations that are specifically the things that he's making worse. Like, he could have done women's health and neonatal vaccinations or whatever that aren't things that
he have chosen literally anything, because he's a rich person and he gets to decide what he does with his time and what his interests are.
Yep.
So, which we're getting to. So, he was born in Western Australia. His family is an old-timey Australian family. They operated what was a sheep station and now a cattle station titled Mindaroo. It was founded in the mid-1800s, and in fact, very early on in the history of that station, there was a massacre of First Nations people, which is euphemistically titled the Battle of Mindaroo. It wasn't a battle.
Yeah,
it was
a slaughter.
Yes. So very cool that he has named his charitable organization after this spot on which a massacre occurred. His family's been involved in politics for a while. His great-great-uncle, John Forrest, was Western Australia's first premier. He was also a slavery apologist and talked about how Aboriginal people like to be chained around the neck. So he was a pretty cool guy. So Forrest grows up. He goes to private school. Out of uni, he works as a stockbroker, makes a shitload of money. So he's on the nice guy pipeline, I think this is what we call.
Definitely, definitely, yeah.
So once he'd made himself a sizable chunk of cash, he started a mining company, which is now one of Australia's largest, and it's called Minara Resources. It doesn't really hit the big time until he takes over another enormous mining company in 2003 and renames it Fortescue Metals Group. So Fortescue Metals Group, or let's just call them Fortescue from here on in, their main thing is iron ore. Specifically, they export it to China. And so they're up there with, like, Rio Tinto and BHP in terms of how big their operation is. And in Western Australia specifically, their holdings are bigger than either of those two. So these guys are...
Wow. Yeah, yeah.
We're big fry. So he was taken to court by the Australian Securities and Investment Commission, or ASIC, in 2009 for misleading shareholders. And then there was a shit fight back and forth, some appeals, and he eventually got off. But he resigned as CEO of Fortescue in 2011. Some people suggest that it was kind of under pressure from that court case, because if he lost, he was basically going to have to step down.
Yep.
he was also kind of notable around that time for being vocally opposed to the Gillard government's mining tax, which you can, I mean,
obviously
doesn't take
he
a
was.
Genius
yeah,
to
yeah.
figure that he would speak out against it. That's how he's making his money. Famously, he called it economic vandalism. Yeah, it's funny that he considers economic vandalism taxing companies who have annual turnovers of over $75 million, but whatever. Also a bit rich considering that in 2011 it was revealed that Fortescue had paid zero company tax.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly like
he was going to get
hemorrhaging
yeah.
cashed. Like, yeah, fucking hell. But so, yeah, as I mentioned, in 2011 he stepped down to focus on Indigenous philanthropy.
Uh-huh.
Because what you got to understand about Andrew Forrest is he's just got a deep and abiding love of this land's Indigenous peoples. So in the early 2010s, he started a couple of charitable foundations to these ends. Probably the most notable one is called Generation One, which he started up with money from his own pockets and also with donations from James Packer and Kerry Stokes, who chipped in a bunch of money from the TV stations they respectively owned at the time, Channel 9 and Channel 7, who are notoriously good friends of Australia's Aboriginal people and devote themselves to fair and balanced reporting on their issues and fighting racism wherever they find it. So very cool start to that organization. So the mission of Generation One is to close the gap in one generation through jobs. 50,000 jobs, to be precise, including 1,000 of those jobs with New South Wales Police. If this all sounds kind of like very run-of-the-mill, almost like stereotypical white savior bullshit, well, I think that I'll be able to dissuade you from that opinion by playing you just a little bit of this promotional song released by Generation One.
If you help me and I help you, think of all the things that we could do if we all joined hands across Australia. There's so much hope in this big land, in every woman, child, man, when we all join hands across Australia. For generations and generations, we believe that this great nation has ever seen.
Tomorrow is a brighter day. Wanna come together to make a change. And we all join hands across Australia.
Oh, you help me, I help you. Think of all the things that we could do.
All right, that's enough of that.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, it's like something out of a sitcom, I swear to God. All these, like, white vocalists singing country style with their, you know, fake American accents. Pretty amazing. So the other thing that kind of was introduced around this time to concur with Generation One was something called the Australian Employment Covenant. So this was something set up by Forrest, which was aimed at trying to get businesses to pledge to hire Indigenous people. So this was introduced with the support of Kevin Rudd at the time, and I got this quote here from him, which has Noon's pinching his brow, and well he might. Kevin Rudd says the scheme will encourage Indigenous Australians to, quote, step out of welfare and step up to permanent full-time paying jobs. Under the Australian Employment Covenant, Indigenous Australians who want to work will be encouraged to opt out of the welfare system. The government welcomes this imaginative and ambitious plan.
Wow.
Yes,
imaginative, ambitious. We will hire people. It's both ambitious and imaginative. Absolutely. We kind of glossed over it, but the idea of closing the gap in one generation is already ridiculous, but then that the way to do it is only by jobs. Like, obviously, there's a whole lot of shit that won't fix, but it's imaginative, ambitious, apparently. So, you know, if it's good enough for Kevin Rudd.
The best form of welfare is a job.
Mm-hmm.
Andrew Forrest is a big best form of welfare is a job kind of guy.
Yeah.
It's also worth pointing out that this Australian Employment Covenant thing is still going.
Right.
And I found an article where he was like announcing some milestone that he'd hit alongside Malcolm Turnbull. So, you know, he's a rich guy. He doesn't really have super strong political affiliations. Governments will just do whatever he says and wants because he's got so much fucking money. Also, a fun quote here from Forrest about the Australian Employment Covenant. He said, "I'm not doing this because I'm a great guy. I'm doing it because it's good business." Very cool.
Yeah.
So,
wow.
Yeah, the goal there was to
because it specifically makes him seem worse. Like, I know he's trying to be humble, but like, you can be humble without being like, "Oh no, I'm just extremely selfish.
I'm doing this for the clams." Yeah. Yeah, which I love. Yeah, like, we're definitely going to achieve racial equality and eliminate structural disadvantage by telling people that it just makes economic sense.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So he's a great communicator. So that project aimed to employ 50,000 First Nations people. You want to guess what the real number was?
I don't know, like 20,000? I'm not sure. No idea.
I mean, you're heading in the right direction. Hard numbers are hard to come by,
sure.
Because as you can imagine, but the actual number apparently seems to be under 5,000. So
wow.
wasn't exactly a resounding success.
Jeez.
But I want to back up a little bit at this stage and focus in on one particular story, which I think is really emblematic of the way that Andrew Forrest thinks of Indigenous people beyond just the welfare, the jobs welfare thing. So in 2007, Fortescue was trying to secure some mining leases in the Solomon Hub area. So that's in the Pilbara region, which is northern Western Australia. And this mining project was supposed to be happening on the land of the Yinchibandi people. The main town in that area is called Roeburn. It's got a population of about 1,000 people. So negotiations began with the Yinchibandi Aboriginal Corporation. And they stalled pretty quickly. But in 2009, Fortescue was awarded exploration licenses by the state government without the permission of the Yinchibandi people, so they got to work mining. They estimated that they were going to extract roughly $280 billion worth of ore over 40 years from this Solomon Hub project. What they offered to the First Nations people, they offered a $500,000 signing fee and a capped amount of $4 million in cash a year, plus a few extra million in staff, housing, jobs and training, and what they call business opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
So the Yinchibandi Aboriginal Corporation, the head of the corporation is a guy called Michael Woodley. And he said that if they accepted the deal, it would be like selling their soul to the devil. He also pointed out that there were other deals being struck by other mining companies with First Nations people, which had way more favorable terms for the landowners. He pointed to a Rio Tinto deal specifically, which offered the traditional owners $2 billion over 40 years, which is obviously far in excess of what Fortescue and Forrest were offering to the Yinchibandi people. So this became a little bit of a, you know, it was a big national story for a while. So there was a Four Corners episode on it in 2011. And Forrest made the news with this quote. He said that offering more cash, improving the terms of the deal, would be, quote, mining welfare. He said, "If you want to join me one evening after 11 o'clock and walk down the streets of Roeburn and have little girls come up to you, offer themselves for any type of service you want for the cost of a cigarette, then you've come to the end of the line. I'm not going to encourage, with our cash, that kind of behavior."
Wait. So, but if they have more money, there'll be more that will
happen.
Sorry, listeners. Normally, yes. I try to actually use real sentences on this show, but I am just astounded at the complete lack of coherence or any kind of point there. Like, what he's really saying is, like, Aboriginal people bad, sex work bad, no welfare.
Yes. Well, it's much more important to a racist to be racist than it is to be comprehensible.
That makes sense.
So he's really, you know, he's hitting his top line targets there. His secondary targets maybe not hitting quite as well.
Sure.
So in response to this, five women from the town of Roebourne lodged a complaint with the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission. Their statement said, quote, "This is a vilification of a racist kind that stirs up a bad reputation and hatred of our people."
True enough.
One of the women who drafted that complaint, her name was Pansy Sambo, and she said, "We are sick of this prejudice that black marks Roebourne and gives our community a bad name. This has a terrible effect on our morale, on our spirit and confidence as a community. We feel humiliated and shamed." And Michael Woodley, the head of the Yindjibarndi Corporation, said, "Mr. Forrest's offensive story is no justification for cheating the Yindjibarndi people out of an honest and fair agreement over his Solomon Hub project."
Absolutely.
And I think it's hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, even if your racist story is true, what the fuck has that got to do with anything?
Right.
Like, why are you bringing this up? This is a debate over whether or not you're paying a fair price for the land that you are already mining without permission.
Yep.
So the case worked its way through the courts. In 2017, the Yindjibarndi people were finally awarded exclusive rights over that section of the Pilbara that contained the Solomon Hub operation. And they have pretty much immediately said that they're going to launch a compensation claim against Fortescue Metals.
Good.
Michael Woodley said, "We believe strongly that they are liable for what they've been doing for the last 8 years in our country, mining without our prior and informed consent." And the most recent development in that case is that Fortescue appealed and lost in late 2019. And I just wanted to read this quote from the judgment, which I think sums up the issue pretty succinctly.
Sure.
So it says, "Implicit in these comments is the notion that the exercise of traditional rights over country is in some way a less legitimate form of occupancy than that seen in the context of Anglo-Australian relationships to real property. Such a position is to misunderstand the concept of native title rights and interests to require them to fit into non-Aboriginal concepts of property, the exercise of proprietary rights, and the enforcement of property rights. That is why what occurs is recognition of native title, not conferral, and not transformation into non-Aboriginal property rights."
That's really interesting. It reminds me of the stuff that I'm sure it happened here as well, but I normally hear it in the context of like Native Americans, of people coming and, as in colonists coming and signing contracts that are like, we'll buy this land for some glass beads or whatever, but that the whole concept of owning land was not one that featured in the people's like legal and social system. So like they didn't, and I'm sure this was different in different situations, but like they didn't understand the concept of selling land because it's not the kind of thing that can be bought and sold.
Exactly.
But I think this is really, this is actually pretty amazing from a like an Australian
judge I thought it
to
was,
be like,
yeah, I
our
was,
property
I,
rights
that's why I included the quote.
Yeah,
exactly. So yeah, I mean, it was definitely, it's a good judgment, but it's very true that basically Forrest thinks that the way in which Indigenous people own the land is basically something that he can disregard if it is inconvenient for him.
Totally.
He thinks that it means less than colonial law, than what the Australian state classifies as ownership. So yeah, I just thought that judgment was a very neat encapsulation of that. So that case might make its way to the High Court at some point in the future. So it's still ongoing. Huge long fight for the Yindjibarndi community.
Yeah.
I think it tells you a lot about the way that Forrest regards First Nations people. But, you know, he is somebody who basically, because he made a whole bunch of money, earned the right to appoint himself an expert on whatever he felt like. And he chose the subject of Indigenous people. He was like, yeah, I care about Indigenous people. I had a guy, an Indigenous mentor growing up, you know? That's what I'm interested in.
It kind of reminds me of Tony Abbott, who I think
appointed himself Prime Minister for First Nations people.
Yeah. But like, I think he honestly, in his own mind, really thinks he does care about Aboriginal people and wants to do good for them. But the only way that he can imagine doing that is like cruel and destructive and kills people. And the same with Twiggy is that he's like, oh, yeah, I really care. It's important to me and my own image of myself that I care about these people. But I actually just want to get paid, so fuck them. And, like,
it's interesting that you bring up Abbott, actually.
Sure.
Because, you know, basically, Forrest has designated himself an expert on Indigenous policy. Because he's a rich guy and has chosen to do that. And that is a line that's been swallowed hook, line, and sinker by the mainstream media and also by government. So when the Abbott government needed someone to conduct a review into Indigenous employment and training programs, who did they go to? Andrew Forrest. And what's the result of that review? The cashless welfare card. So they go to this guy who claims that... You know, he's created a whole organization around the idea of closing the gap. He claims to understand that there's a massive disparity in the health and well-being of Indigenous populations in Australia and non-Indigenous. And his recommendation is that we need to go and restrict the way that these people can spend their money. We need to make sure that they're not spending it on anything that we think is inappropriate.
Yep.
So... We don't have time here to go into all of the ins and outs of the Indu cashless welfare card.
We talked about it like 6 months ago or something, I think, as a mains.
Yeah, we've definitely discussed it briefly on the show before. Mm. But yeah, it's a fucking disaster. Around half of the people on the card have said that the card has actively made their life worse.
Yeah, because
it restricts 80% of their income. Of course it has. So, you know, you can't get cash out. Makes it really hard to buy secondhand stuff.
Of course.
One thing I came across in my research that I hadn't realized before is that you can't use eBay with the card.
Whoa.
And a whole bunch of other online shops.
Wow.
And there was a story from somebody who was having their income, quote-unquote, quarantined on the card. He was talking about trying to buy secondhand stuff from Facebook Marketplace. Mm. In order to do that, they had to take a screenshot of the advertisement in question and make an application to Indu, which is the company that administers the card, and then wait a few days until they get a response from this company saying whether or not they considered this thing an appropriate object for them to buy.
Which obviously on Marketplace and eBay often means that you don't get the item, but like...
Of course.
That's almost secondary to it being cruel and dehumanizing.
It's, you know, a system that robs people of their independence, it robs them of their dignity. It's fucking humiliating.
Yep.
You never know where your card is going to get turned down.
Fuck.
There were stories of people trying to buy jeans. No, card turned down. A nursing student trying to buy a stethoscope and uni books turned down on the basis that spending money at that shop, she could have been trying to buy hand sanitizers to drink. That was the justification given.
What the hell?
Which, you know, brings up this whole other question as well of, in the midst of a crisis like this, oh no, you can't buy hand sanitizer?
Yeah.
Or, you know, like, just absolutely disgusting shit.
I just wanted to say one thing quickly about the welfare card is that it's an almost exact replication of the way that black slaves were treated in this country and the way that, like, their income was quote-unquote, like, quarantined by the overseers and that they would have to go and ask their employer to, like, have access to the cash that they had already been paid. And it's exactly the same. Like, they literally have to be like, please let me spend my own money. And, yeah, anyway, it's just awful.
No,
it's disgusting.
And it's very relevant because that slaving history is in Forrest's family.
Yes.
The station that he named his charitable organization after is built on the labor of the Aboriginal slaves.
Not to mention the literal corpses of black people that were
On stolen land. Like, so, you know, this guy's family has a long history of this, and now suddenly he is best friend to the First Nations people, until, of course, they interrupt his business ventures or somehow become inconvenient.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, at this stage, I was going to invite a little bit of discussion about the nature of philanthropy and how it's fucked up, that basically if you get rich enough, you can then just basically dictate public policy and get appointed by the government to implement whatever solutions you see fit on the basis of you're rich. That's your credentials. But we're kind of running out of time here. But I just thought that basically this guy's story of being somebody who has decided that he's an expert in the way that poor people generally and Indigenous people specifically should live, and then just got rich enough to basically do what he thought was right in that area, and was given basically unfettered control by the government to do that.
It's horrifying.
But so now he's protecting his own business interests by inviting Chinese diplomats to speak at press conferences and that kind of thing. And the government is suddenly realizing that maybe they've given this billionaire a little bit too much leash. Suddenly it's coming back to bite them a little bit. In America, for example, the influence of money in politics and billionaires specifically is something that's pretty out in the open. It's discussed quite a lot, I feel. Everybody knows who Jeff Bezos is. Here, I think it's talked about a little bit less, and we've definitely got Murdoch, but he's kind of he's a media mogul. It's a little bit different. We've definitely got Eugenia Reinhart.
He's also kind of American.
Exactly, which is the other kind of complicating factor. You know, we're small fry in some ways, but Twiggy Forrest is the quintessential Australian billionaire. And we've just got this culture where basically being as wealthy as he is seems to make him, gives him the power to basically do whatever he wants. And now the government is suddenly starting to get a little bit squeamish about the fact that he's running around
praising,
you know, protecting
China
his business interests at the, like, you know, in as they see it, at, you know, the detriment to the national interest.
Yeah.
That's a conversation that we're not going to get into, whether or not that's true or not. But, I mean, what the fuck do you think was going to happen if this guy is like, hey, apropos of nothing, I'm an expert on this subject. And the government is like, yeah, sure, cool. Conduct a review. We'll do whatever you say. We'll co-sponsor all of your business initiatives, which you claim to be social programs. What did they think was going to happen? That he was going to be like, cool, yeah, I'll just stop there. Like, no.
Yeah.
You need to curtail the influence of these people. I mean, the government is never going to do it because they're beholden to the cash. And that this, it's also this, like, I don't know, like bowing down to the business acumen of this great guy. So they, like, outsource the task of getting medical gear to him. His foundation is going to get reimbursed for all the money that they spent on that, by the way. It's not like a charitable fucking donation. He's operating as like this, as an arm of government in some ways. He's developing policies, heading up initiatives, medical resourcing tasks are getting outsourced to him. It's very, very fucking strange. But anyway, I thought it was a fascinating look
at that's really
one
good.
Person who has way too much influence over Australian public discourse and policy. But it's also fun to see him starting to get a few slaps on the wrist from the media and the government as he oversteps his boundaries. So it'll be interesting to see how that develops.
Thanks heaps for putting the research in for that, Zach. That's really interesting. I obviously have, like, as you said, seen Andrew Forrest and his various companies in the media at various times, but it's good to get a bit more info about sort of the shithead behind the man.
And they're just like, you assume that he's bad and that his organizations and companies are bad.
Yeah.
But they're just so much worse than you'd even think, really.
Yeah.
Like, it's just fucking shocking stuff, really.
All right, we're running over time, so I'm just going to do this last little positivity corner real quick. Why don't you play that sting and take us out.
Positivity corner.
So most people probably have heard this. This was a tweet from Professor Peter Doherty, who said, Dan Murphy opening hours. And Peter Doherty is the founder of the Doherty Institute. He's an immunologist and vet surgeon. He has a Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering how T cells recognize their target antigens in combination with major histocompatibility complex proteins, which obviously everyone knows what that means, so I'm not going to explain it anymore. But he tweeted Dan Murphy opening hours. He's quoted an SBS article. He said, I had both Outlook and a web browser open on the computer, working on emails. A lot of contacts regarding help with COVID-19 coming through my email, and I send them on. At age 79, the wires get crossed sometimes, but I'd rather have a bottle in front of me than a frontal lobotomy.
It's just been the bright spot that we needed on Twitter this week.
Yeah.
You know, it's got, like, his tweet has 10,000 likes.
Yeah, and he picked up, like, 1,000 followers in, like, the 4 hours after it. Yeah, it's very
He's
sweet.
Just been a really good sport about it as well.
Yep.
Like, he's left the tweet up and has made a few jokes, as you said.
Totally.
And he went on to, like, make a snide comment about Donald Trump. So, you know, which is, like, a bit of a gimme on Twitter these days,
sure.
Let's be honest. But it's just, it's nice to see a little bit of wholesome fun on Twitter every now and again.
Definitely.
You know? Nice to see a little bit of humor that's not just like, hey, I have irony poisoning. Isn't that cute?
It's true. Yeah, there's a complete lack of irony in all of this. Yeah.
Yeah, deeply earnest. Well, as earnest as you can possibly get
on Twitter.
Just typing your typing your search terms into the Twitter bar instead. Very cute stuff.
All right, that's going to do it for us for this week. Thank you all for tuning in again, and thank you to our wonderful patrons and our shadowy financiers. And if you love the show, you can support us on Patreon. If you get give us $1 a month, you get a bonus episode. We're also about to record our Marxist meme mini series, so they'll start coming out this week. They'll be released to everyone, but they are funded by our wonderful patrons. So if you're listening to them and enjoying them, just thank our patrons. And if you don't want to give us money, that's also totally fine. But we would love it if you could leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify, wherever you listen to your podcasts, or even on Facebook. Just go to our Facebook page, Ozpol Snackpod, leave us a review. It would be really nice, and we will read it out. And I think that's us for the week.
Yeah. Thanks for spending the time, Noon. It's always a pleasure.
Always.
Keep on snacking in the free world.
Crunch, crunch.